All right, well, the last couple of weeks we have been involved in some church history, a phenomena in the early part of the 19th century, commonly referred to as the Second Great Awakening, consisting of a movement of camp meetings and revivals that flourished on the untamed frontier of America's westward expansion. Though Kentucky was initially the hub of these, the movement soon spread to virtually every corner of the country. On the first week, I gave a brief survey to some of the history itself, dates, names, places, and events. Last week, we then began to look at some of the ways the impact of those revivals from 200 years ago can still be felt even to this day. I listed four that were very positive and two that weren't so positive. Today, I want to pick up where we left off and finish out the list, and this in turn will wrap up our three-week series. Though there was a great temptation to expand this to just one more week, but not going to. Before we get started, let's review the first 6 points on the list that I went over last week. And the reason is these are very important, and they are worth going over again. Oh, I forgot to show you this picture. Can you see it okay? Can I get the lights? This is John Schutz sent me this and thought it was appropriate for today. Can you read the marquee? Isn't that funny? All right. We can have the lights back on. I forgot all about that until I saw it there on the slide. All right. No more laughing the rest of Sunday. Beginning with some of that which was good, we do see that the Second Great Awakening brought about a renewed emphasis on the need to have a personal commitment to God. Up to this time, Christian was little more than a religious designation, kind of like one's nationality. This revival movement helped people see a need to personally repent from sin and personally subject themselves to Christ's lordship. And this emphasis continues within evangelical Christianity to this day. We also see a genuine passion for evangelism. The joys of conversion experienced at these revivals compelled new believers to share their faith with family members, friends, and neighbors. And generally, this evangelism took on the form of inviting them to a camp meeting revival. Though methods and techniques have evolved, since that time, this thrust to spread the gospel has continued to be a defining mark of the evangelical church. Thirdly, we also see this valuable lesson here that God can work outside established norms. The revivals at Cumberland and Cane Ridge in particular taught us that techniques and methods to reach others with God's truth must adapt to the culture we find ourselves in. The camp meeting setting, a new concept at that time, was used mightily by God to reach the lost. And in each generation, the church needs to be reminded of the need to consider avenues outside the traditional ways of doing things. And fourth, the Great Awakening significantly shaped our country into an evangelical nation. Thousands were converted, churches grew at an astounding rate, untold number of lives were dramatically transformed. Again, the prayer of the Presbyterian General Assembly to redeem the frontier from, quote, the Egyptian darkness, was certainly heard by God. Right, and now for a couple howevers that we went over last week. Unfortunately, soon after, we find this stubborn problem, one that seems to plague the church of every generation, of what we call codifying techniques. That is, of trusting in certain strategies and methods and you know, fixing them into concrete and then just being unwilling to let go of them when we need to. The camp meeting revival movement broke from the established methods of evangelism of its day, yet ironically, these new methods then became the way to do it that have been held to with great conviction ever since, as though they themselves have been divinely ordained, and now they've become fixed in concrete. The strategy, for instance, of the evangelistic crusade, be it a camp meeting or a tent revival or a week a long series of special services at a church or even a Sunday morning service is a perfect example of this. It is nowhere as effective in the year 2011 as it was in 1811. And there are many reasons for this. Altar calls, of course, would be another example. The origin of this practice is not the New Testament, but these 19th century revival meetings. So again, the lesson we should take from Cane Ridge is not the method of evangelism it used, but the fact that methods of evangelism have to adapt to the times and culture. And then finally from last week, In the Second Great Awakening, evangelism was elevated above all else, overshadowing other obligations of the church as mandated by the New Testament, especially discipleship. Before this time, the Sunday gathering was an opportunity for believers to hear instruction from the Word, participate in the Lord's Supper together, worship in unison. But soon we see a shift. Discipleship and training is pushed over to Sunday school, while the main service then becomes an evangelistic meeting complete with a come-and-get-saved sermon and followed up, of course, with an altar call. Hymns that once proclaimed the great truths about God's attributes and works are replaced with gospel songs that sing about the joys of one's conversion. Everything centers around persuading the non-believer to walk down that aisle at the end of the service. And so instead of equipping believers to evangelize themselves, the church instead encouraged members to bring the lost to a Sunday service where the preacher, the professional, could perform that task. And even the newer contemporary mega churches, though using perhaps different methods, have adopted the philosophy of this model. The goal is to make the service as appealing to the non-believer as possible, hoping that he will be receptive to the church experience. And this, of course, is done at the expense of watering down the sermon and watering down the song service and everything else. All right, we could add many more to the list, but I'm trying to focus just on the major ones here in this series, and so I just have two more to add to today, and that will give us a total of four good outcomes from the Second Great Awakening and four not-so-good ones. The seventh one that we have inherited from the 19th century revivals is this troublesome shift from discipling a congregation to entertaining an audience. And I believe this to be in large part an unintentional consequence, and no doubt would have eventually happened regardless of the Second Great Awakening, but that movement certainly greased the wheels for this. So let me set up the picture here again. We have these revival meetings going on at a festive-type campground setting, open-air forums consisting of knock-em-dead type evangelistic preaching, colorful and moving testimonies, gospel music, highly charged altar calls, and so on. I mean, no doubt about it, while they may have been quite convicting and serious, there was also this aspect of them where they were just downright entertaining. And that's a big reason why people came. It was the thing to do, the place to go. They drew large crowds, which itself contributed to this entertainment factor. And if the revival meetings weren't entertaining enough, there were usually opportunities out in the campgrounds for something. A couple weeks ago, I spoke of problems with gambling and drunkenness and even sexual mischief. In some ways, these events were a little bit like Woodstock. No doubt, some preachers felt a certain pressure to pull all the people in to the revival meeting itself. And so they had to be on top of their game. And if they wanted people to come to the next camp meeting, they had to live up to expectations and deliver. There was this pressure to get an audience, to keep that audience, and then bring that audience to a response, as in walking forward during an altar call. That pressure, which started back then, remains with us to this day. With a slight modification, today the ultimate response, pressure, sought after is seeing everyone come back the following week. This pressure to deliver drives just about everything a church plans out for its Sunday service. Sunday gatherings in the modern church have become less and less about instructing, encouraging, admonishing, and equipping believers, and more about inspiring them, engaging them, stimulating and motivating them, even entertaining them. In fact, this is the new Great Commission. We have to make sure that people will keep coming and will bring others with them, whatever it takes. It has gotten to the point that church leaders now see people sitting out in the rows as an audience rather than a congregation. They are consumers, and we have to make sure that what they see, that they like what they see, that it fulfills their expectations and meets their demands. The pressure is on. In fact, this pressure is reinforced by the acute awareness of stiff competition. If, as a church, we fail to meet consumer demands, other churches will. Now, hundreds of examples could be given for all this, but for purposes today, I want to mention five that especially stand out, or five that are especially noticeable to me anyway. The first one deals with the content and the presentation of a Sunday sermon. 19th century revival preachers had to be passionate, interesting, and enjoyable to listen to. Speaking extemporaneously proved more effective than reading from a script that was prepared ahead of time. Appealing to people's emotions worked better than presenting logical arguments. And this pretty much is the standard for today. It has become the model preachers are encouraged to imitate, even in most Bible colleges. Up to this time, before the Second Great Awakening, a typical sermon consisted of exegeting a passage of Scripture or explaining a theological concept. And pastors would write their sermons out and read them to the congregation. The pressure was always on the people to listen and pay attention and learn. It was never on the pastor to make his lecture fun and engaging. Now, obviously, for better or worse, this has now shifted 180 degrees. And this explains the compelling need to load up a sermon with funny stories and anecdotes and marshmallow filling. We have been conditioned as listeners and as speakers to judge a speech like a sermon by how well it holds the attention of the listeners rather than by the truths that are presented. Pastors of the biggest churches today are not those who say anything worthwhile, but those who have mastered the skill of tickling the ears. The pressure to indulge and amuse the listener is great. If you have any doubts about this, look no further than Sunday messages delivered by professional Christian comedians. This is becoming more and more popular. It's not new. It's not out of the ordinary at all. A Christian comedian is one thing, but taking on the assignment of proclaiming the Sunday message in the form of comedy, the question is, why would we do that? The only reason to do that is because the people are an audience to be indulged, not a congregation to be discipled. The pressure to entertain has grabbed our throats in a chokehold. This past spring, Terry and I visited a church during my study break that, unknown to us beforehand, had scheduled a Christian comedian to give the message that morning. Admittedly, he was very funny. I mean, he had the whole place laughing in no time and kept them laughing. He even had me chuckling a few times, though I was determined ahead of time not to. Right? Now, I couldn't exactly follow his main points and left a bit confused about what the message itself was, but the sermon was a blast, I have to admit, and people loved it. But seriously, when you actually stand back and think about this sort of thing, shouldn't this be a bit alarming that we now have to use nonstop comedy to keep people's attention on a Sunday morning? But, you know, given the age we live in, with all this fast-action drama and glitz from television and movies and sports and the internet and Xbox and everything else, Christian comedians might actually be the face of the next generation of pastors. A second example of the shift from discipling a congregation to indulging them is the including of special performances to a Sunday service. Solos and duets and musical numbers and skits and dramas and interpretive dances and outside performers coming in and so on. A few years ago, it was kind of the in thing to have muscle men come in and give displays of strength. You know, a guy would lift a motorcycle up over his head or bend an iron bar in half and then share his testimony. You know, everyone here, it's no surprise, everyone's well aware of the severe allergic reaction I have even upon the suggestion of including a performance of any type on a Sunday morning. And so, you know, all this behind my back grumblings that goes on in this church about how I'm a rigid tyrant, inflexible, controlling, closed-minded, it's all true when it comes to this area. When it comes to this area, it's all true. Is it wrong to have a skit during a Sunday service? No. To have a quartet sing, "I'll Fly Away"? It's not wrong. To give Larry... Is it wrong to give Larry, the 16-year-old who's a member of the high school marching band, an opportunity to play the trombone during the offering time? No. How about an interpretive dance while the choir sings "Shine, Jesus, Shine"? Everyone says, yeah, that would be wrong. Right. Greg was just a few steps ahead of the queue there. All right. Whenever I ask the question, why would we do this, I have never found a satisfying answer. It just seems to me that a lot of this is driven by a need to keep people engaged. We have to keep the service moving with lots of different acts so as not to bore anyone. It seems that variety shows on television have become the model for planning a Sunday service. Most of us grew up in churches and thought nothing of it when, during the offering time, for instance, Sister Isabel would bless the congregation with a musical rendition of the Lord's Prayer, or Brother Ernie would sing, "How Great Thou Art." And again, I can't say there's anything inherently wrong with any of this. There's certainly no verse in the Bible that condemns it. But it just seems to me, and maybe I'm crazy, or maybe I'm just in, you know, being inflexible and controlling and closed-minded. I don't know. But it seems to me that when the church family comes together, it's more appropriate to sing songs together with one voice to God as worship, rather than have someone stand up front and sing to all the rest of us while we just sit there and watch. It's the direction of the thing that kind of bugs me. It just feels like entertainment. If it's all about the content of the song and not about the performance, as the argument usually goes, then why is it that we only schedule the good singers to sing during the offering time? I mean, how is one person or even a group singing a song to you to be preferred over everyone singing to God? Well, a number of years ago, we had a family visit here for a couple months. This is another one of those family laugh type things, you know. Got a lot of these stories. A number of years ago, we had a family visit here for a couple months who were big into drama and theater. And they wanted to make us their church home, but they needed some assurance that opportunities would be given to them on Sunday mornings to perform dramas. Well, I liked the family quite a bit, and I really wanted them to come here, but I wasn't very encouraging along this line. The best I could offer was the New Year's Eve party, the freak show, you know, talent night that we have like every 3 or 4 years, and that's the best I could do. All right, speaking of music during the offering, I have to let you in on the recent tussle between Dave Stevens and myself. This is a sidebar thing. It's not part of the sermon. I provide this strictly for your entertainment purpose, okay? Dave, who isn't here this morning to defend himself, approached me a couple weeks ago about having instrumental music play during the slides that we showed during the offering. And he was concerned that I would say no because, you know, it would look too much like entertainment. But pointed out that the silence during the offering was awkward and that someone in the church had mentioned this as well. Who was that person? I want to know. Well, I told him that entertainment, that wasn't the issue, for it's simply background music. It's not like someone's giving a performance. And after all, I'm not that rigid. But I went on to explain that I actually like the quiet time, that the music could be distracting when people are trying to concentrate on the content of the slides. And I went on to ask rhetorically and sarcastically, why do we have to feel that everything in our lives has to be filled with noise, you know? And so we've been going back and forth with this, and I've agreed to give it a try, and I told him that we would evaluate it in a month or two. And what he thought I meant by that and what I actually meant by that are actually two different things. He thought that we would get comments and feedback from the congregation. My evaluation comes down to this. If by chance offerings increase, then we'll keep the practice. That's what it comes down to. What? That would be a sign. That's right. I'm not above that at all. So, and in fact, if they really increased, then I'm certainly not opposed to having Sister Isabel sing the Lord's Prayer during the offering time. So if you don't like the background music, tell Dave Stevens. If you do like it, there's no need to tell anyone. All right, let's move on. A third example. would be this whole practice of elevating the testimonies of converts. The revival preachers use this technique all the time. The more dramatic the conversion, the more it pulled in the crowds, and through the years this has evolved into some really strange things. I mean, consumers seem to like really dirty laundry. And so, no surprise here, we have seen a number of converts hitting the circuit, going around on the national scene, taking on kind of a celebrity status these days, talking to churches and at Christian concerts and conferences about their days in satanic cults or Illuminati groups or gangs or mafia, giving astounding, colorful testimonies of God dramatically rescuing them from the grip of Satan. Gory details, frightening stories, unimaginable depravity. Only to find out that such stories were complete lies, you know, fairy tales. This compelling drive to entertain an audience and the insatiable appetite of an audience to be entertained is just as debased inside Christianity as anywhere else. A fourth area would be the type of songs we use in church services. Gospel songs, songs that sing about the joys of one's conversion with catchy choruses at the end of each verse. You know, there's nothing wrong with them, and they, you know, certainly they're a lot more fun to sing than the majestic hymns that focus on God's attributes and works. But we do see the shift. You know, since Jesus came into my heart, we'll get a lot more response from a crowd than Isaac Watts' Great God, How Infinite Art Thou. And today we've taken that even further, a song that says nothing at all, zero content, or worse yet, bad content, even heretical content. If it can pull the audience in with a lively, upbeat tune, well, it'll take over the whole time of worship. We'll sing it over and over 30 times as long as people are getting into it. And so here again, we find this subtle shift in worship services, even involving something like the process of how songs are selected. Since the Second Great Awakening, it has become more and more about what an audience responds to and less about what actually glorifies God and proclaims the great truths of the faith. The pressure to excite and amuse and indulge has literally gone out of control. And I think I've shared this example in the past, but it just strikes me. The image of it is still very, very impressed upon my mind. Another church that we'd visited in the area while on a study break a while back had a video camera crew that captured the worship team and fed their signals directly to the large projector screens used to display the words of the songs. And so the congregation would be singing along, and then all of a sudden we would see this close-up on the screens of the worship leader singing and dancing. And then later a close-up of the drummer going at it with the drums. And then later a close-up of the guitarist's fingers mastering his instrument, all while the music played loudly, nonstop. I literally thought I was at a rock concert. It just needed the fog machine and laser light show. It was all there. The seeds of this, as small as they may have been, were planted back in the revival period and have now grown into wild and woolly weeds bearing every kind of thistle and thorn imaginable. Now, let me be clear. I cannot overstate this, and I run the risk of being misunderstood this morning. So let me say this. It is not that any of these things are necessarily wrong or sinful. It's certainly okay for people to enjoy a morning service. It's even okay if at points they were entertained. The issue here isn't whether preachers have amusing sermons, or whether someone sings during the offering, or we have dramas and skits, or invite a man of steel to come in and break an axe in half with his teeth. It's not even loud music, rock bands showing off their talent for all to applaud on Sunday morning, or comedians trying to be preachers. The numerous examples I've listed this morning are not themselves the problem. The problem is that which is driving all this. A yielding to this pressure to see the congregation as an audience that expects to be appeased, pampered, and indulged, rather than a community of believers who need to be instructed, equipped, trained, and yes, at times even admonished. We are doing things today that would startle, shock the old-time revival preachers of the 19th century, much less the apostles of the first century church. All right, let me offer one more example, and then we'll move on to the next point for today. Due to the influence of the Second Great Awakening, the actual physical structure or layout of the church sanctuary changed, taking on the format of a theater arrangement, a semicircle. Up to this time, and we still see it in many liturgical churches today, the common layout was that of a very long row, narrow sanctuary with straight rows all facing forward. Denny mentioned this to me a couple weeks ago, and I found the whole thing really intriguing, and so I looked it up, and sure enough, there's plenty out there to document this change. You may remember from the pictures I showed a couple weeks ago, the stage-like structure that the preacher spoke from which the people gathered around. Again, these revival services were a sight to behold, something not just to hear, but also something to watch. Soon, churches adopted this into their architecture. And today, it is common to find stadium-site seating with a sloped floor, a large stage or elevated platform that includes not just a pulpit, but a place for musicians and singers and various props. We have it here. Elaborate sound systems and theater-type lighting with various spots and all the various colors that go with that. It all reflects this subtle change from an audience that once listened to sermons, thus the long rows, to that of watching something on a stage. Now, my point here is not to say that the long, narrow row setting is the right way and the theater arrangement is the wrong way. Indeed, arguments could be made to show that the previous layout also had problems and contributed to a distorted view of what a church meeting should be. My point, however, is to note the change and the reason for it. The long, narrow rows produced a setting of listening to a sermon, not watching one. There is a difference. And when people sang, they did not focus on an individual up front or a team of musicians, but upon the majestic ornaments and architecture and stained glass which decorated the front wall, all designed to help set a mood of reverence and awe for appreciating God's glory. Today's architecture, on the other hand, accommodates this element of, again, watching something, of expecting a performance to take place before us, at least on some level. It's subtly there in our mind, at least on a subconscious level. It is both the result of and a contributing factor to this infusing of entertainment into worship. And again, just to be clear, it's not inherently wrong, but we should recognize where it came from and what it brings with it and what it is a symptom of. The Great Commission isn't about making sure people like what you do at church so that they will come back. It's about teaching them to obey all that Christ has commanded. The congregation, whether they like it or not, whether they want it or not, and whether they will accept it or not, must be pushed and admonished and challenged and taught and encouraged and even commanded to grow and mature and become holy even as Christ is holy. To pamper Christians as consumers who want to be indulged is perhaps the greatest of insults. The mission of the church is to call her people to nothing less than conformity to Christ. And if we love them, then that is what we will do. And for the true believer, that is what they want the church to do anyway. All right, let's move on to the next point. And could be running just a little long here, but this is in response to John Nelson, who has complained to me that my sermons are too short. And now that he's becoming an elder, I actually have to start to listen to him. So,
you never listened to me.
Well, you never came to the meetings on time. You forfeit your right to be listened to whenever you come in late. That's true in elders' meetings, it's true on Sunday morning, it's true at the picnic. Wegmans, you'll be there this year, right?
Stop entertaining us.
All right. I tell you, I'm a victim of this too, and I play into it. All right, we are ready for number 8. Just keep in mind that sermons before the 19th century averaged an hour and a half long, so... All right, we have to talk about this other great shift that has taken place in the last 200 years in the church, which started in these revivals, and it is a shift from the mind to the emotions, resulting in an anti-intellectualism that has infected the church ever since. And it continues to get worse with every succeeding generation. This one is so huge that a whole sermon series, it deserves a whole sermon series in itself, like a 10-year sermon series. We've talked about this problem in the past and has been a dominant theme in E4. And in fact, E4 is one of the ways our own church is trying to combat this. Again, the revival preachers of the 19th century camp meeting soon discovered that appealing to people's emotions when presenting the gospel produced more results than setting forth a logical case. And as you will remember, the camp meetings themselves became a haven of emotional exhibitions. Everything from loud wailing over sin to shouts of joy to dancing and twirling around to running and jerking and even falling over as though in a deep spiritual trance. All of this contributed to the elevating of one's feelings over that of one's thinking. And indeed, even to this day, most Christians, unfortunately, equate spirituality with a feeling. Now, just to be clear, emotional experiences themselves are not the problem. Emotion, of course, is good. It's part of the way God has made us. A lot could be said about this, but we must understand that emotion has its limits. It was never intended to be the means by which we determine spirituality. We are not to trust in our emotions when we make decisions. Emotion is not how we discern good from evil or right from wrong, and so on. With the rise of weight given to emotional appeals and emotional responses and equating emotional feelings with spirituality, the emphasis on the mind was downplayed, sometimes even scorned, and as to be expected, we soon see this rise of anti-intellectualism in the church. One clear example of this from the 19th century, and many could be given, but one very clear would be the downgrading of standards when it came to training the clergy for ministry. The ability to stir the crowds with eloquent speech was more important than having the discipline to rightly interpret Scripture. One's credentials was his silver tongue. Being able to understand and explain theology was secondary. And we see, of course, see a lot of that today. Anybody who has had a dramatic conversion experience or had some supernatural encounter with God is an instant expert, qualified to instruct large audiences on the truths of God. A clear example of these lower standards that can be seen here with the early what are called circuit riders. In sending out itinerant preachers into the expanding frontier, the early Methodists asked four questions about each candidate. Listen to these four questions. Is the man truly converted? Does he know and keep our rules? Can he preach acceptably? And number four, does he have a horse? Francis Asbury, a name you are probably familiar with, who himself a famous circuit rider preacher of this time, taught others that while study may have value, it does not compare to evangelizing. This is where efforts need to be. He even said, quote, I would throw out all the libraries of the world rather than be guilty of losing one soul. Well, the dilemma here he proposes, of course, is a false one, for no one would ever be forced into a choice like that. Yet his words do reveal the anti-intellectual mindset that was typical of his day and has thrived in every generation since within the church. Remember Timothy Dwight from a couple weeks ago, the president of Yale, who during this time gave a series of lectures on the evils of deism, resulting in a third of the student body converting to Christianity. Remember that guy, the grandson of Jonathan Edwards? He was appalled by this willingness to lower the standards for clergy, complaining, and he had, what an argument, complaining that if we demand a 7-year apprenticeship for trades like making a shoe, and a 7-year apprenticeship for making an axe, then how can we not demand those preaching God's word be equipped to learn the scriptures and doctrines of the faith without the same degree of learning, labor, and time? He was very agitated by what he saw going on. John Wesley, many years earlier, anticipating the rise of anti-intellectualism in the church, wrote, quote, it's a fundamental principle with us that to renounce reason is to renounce religion, that religion and reason go hand in hand, that all irrational religion is false religion. Well said. And I would like to know what he would think about a lot of the nonsense going on today. I'm certain he would call it all false religion. Evangelical Christians today are taught to trust their heart, not their minds. That instead of using wisdom and reason and sound judgment that comes from the study of Scripture, for instance, they should simply feel their way. Let the Spirit direct them through the subjective feelings of the heart. The mind will mislead you. The mind craves logic, something God abhors. Well, obviously, as we have presented in a recent series, this approach blatantly contradicts what the Scriptures teach. Nonetheless, such aberrant and screwball concepts are so deeply rooted in our heritage as evangelicals that we will probably never be able to really rid ourselves of them. The answer to anti-intellectualism isn't intellectualism, but offering our minds to God in all of our thinking. This is part of our praise to Him. Indeed, anti-intellectualism is truly the refusal to love the Lord our God with our minds as required by the first of Jesus' commandments, and is therefore sin, plain and clear. Let me wrap this up this morning with these words from Os Guinness, from the book that many of you here have read, Fit Bodies and Fat Minds. I'm going to be reading from page 38, five paragraphs, and every sentence here is actually worth reading four or five times. And he's commenting on these on the aftermath of the revival movement. The trouble was that after the movement of revivalistic pietism swept by, evangelicalism had also become anti-intellectual and anti-theological to a fault. Examples of this anti-theological, anti-intellectualism abound. My theology, Dwight Moody said later, I didn't know I had any. If I had a creed, Sam Jones, the Moody of the South, added, I would sell it to a museum. Billy Sunday did not, quote, know any more about theology, he used to boast, than a jackrabbit knew about ping pong. Faith without theology, faith without theology, creeds fit only for a museum. The theology of a jackrabbit level, something to brag about. The statements themselves are flamboyantly brash, the assumptions behind them appalling, but they reveal our evangelical anti-intellectualism beyond any contradiction. Current versions of anti-intellectual pietism are milder and sometimes even a little uneasy, but they have not been forsworn or renounced. And again, our pietistic flaw shows through. Whenever evangelicals have an experience of direct personal access to God, we are tempted to think or act as if we can dispense with doctrine, sacraments, history, and all the other, quote, superfluous paraphernalia of the church, and make our experience the sum and soul of our faith. Thus, our evangelical experience has become our strength and our weakness. We are people with a true, sometimes a deep experience of God, but we are no longer a people of truth. Only rarely are we serious about theology at a popular level. We are still suspicious of thinking and scholarship. We are still attracted to movements that replace thinking and theology by other emphases, relational, therapeutic, charismatic, and managerial, as in church growth. Some of our ministries and organizations that operate at the highest levels of national life are still deeply, explicitly, and persistently anti-intellectual. And now the last paragraph. Whatever other virtues of these movements and the unquestionable importance of piety, we must courageously repudiate anti-intellectualism for the sin it is. Piety is essential, but it is not sufficient by itself. Truth, thinking, theology, and the place of the mind must be given the emphasis they deserve from followers of Christ. The best way to actually to sum up today and actually to sum up this three-week series. Next week, Nate will be sharing with us, and what he has been working on will definitely not be an anti-intellectual sermon. The subject will be the implications of God's non-existence. So he will be following in on that grand tradition of explaining a theological concept, and we will be looking forward to that. All right, at this time, I forgot to ring the Sunday school, but if we could have the musicians come forward and bring the kids in, we'll continue our worship this morning in song.